Okay, so you remember the Good Samaritan provisions are in force. They're the provisions that say if you're just reposting somebody else's material on your website, and even if you are selective about what you show and what you don't show, you're protected from liability if it's just somebody else's stuff that you're reposting. So this is the clause that makes the Boston Globe, for example, not liable for comments that other people post when they open up an unedited comment stream. They may have their own social reasons for wanting to filter and take comments down. And remember, this is the crazy contradiction that we got into, where poor Ken Zarin got libeled on some website, but couldn't get AOL to take the comments down because AOL decided not to do anything since it was protected by the Good Samaritan provision of the Communications Decency Act, right? So this was this case of, you know, probably overkill, but nonetheless extreme, whether you like it or not, a sort of extremely favorable free speech part of the law. Its intention, you'll remember, was, anybody remember what the intention of the Good Samaritan Clause was?
They do a prodigy, right?
Right. It was supposed to encourage websites to do editing, you know, to do filtering, to get rid of, you know, to create family-friendly sites and so on by saying, you know, if you miss something, it's, you know, we're not going to say, you know, you should have, we're going to hold you responsible for the thing that the 1% that got through, even though you, you know, it was your intention to edit 99%, edit everything out and you got 99% of it. Now, the language was so broad that sites have reacted the other way. They have taken no responsibility, and that's had some peculiar consequences. But that was not what was at stake. The main part of the law, that part survives. The main part of the law, the display provisions, as we say in the book, we made it a crime to use any interactive computer service to display in a manner available to a person under 18 years of age any comment, request, suggestion, proposal, image, or other communication that in context depicts or describes as patently offensive as measured by contemporary community standards, secretary activities, or organs, and then would also fall on anyone who knowingly permits any telecommunications facility under such person's control to be used for such prohibited activities, and it also criminalized the transmission of materials that were obscene or indecent to anybody known to be under 18. So the problem here, the problem with this and what made the civil libertarians crazy was this term indecent, which has no well-established meaning in criminal law, and the fact that you were going, that it was sufficient merely to make stuff available. So putting it up on a website where somebody could get it, you know, if you couldn't just let anybody go there once you had anything that was indecent, because it could be a person under 18. So this basically required creating an age verification technology and having adults register or somehow prove they were adults before they could get to the materials. Okay, so think whatever you want to think about that. And we talked about it a little bit, I think, earlier. Very difficult to do age verification. And when the Supreme Court took this up, because it was challenged very, very early, the court's judgment was that this was an unconstitutional infringement of free speech on the internet because, you know, a lot of people who want to go look about, you know, sexual subjects, even, you know, medical or clinical or whatever, or, you know, gay dating sites or anything like that, would be intimidated if they had to register with somebody in order to go look at the website. So this age proof that they would have to do would have too much of a chilling effect. So that was the sort of reasoning of the Supreme Court when they struck it down. But that's where this, you know, John Perry Barlow flame, if you want to use an unkind term for it, came from. After the law was enacted, before it had been overturned, he went off on this, governments of the industrial world, you giants of flesh and steel, I come from cyberspace. So there's all of this drama. We're creating a world that all may enter without privilege or prejudice, accorded by race, economic power, military force, or state of birth. Anyone anywhere may express his or her beliefs, and you know, and so on and so forth. So this is 1996, trying to ward off the virus of liberty by erecting guard posts at the frontiers of cyberspace. Okay, and Barlow, as you know, is not a computer scientist per se. He is a was the lyricist for the Grateful Dead, but he is a bit of a cult figure in the world of in the cyberspace world, as perhaps you can imagine, become of this. And he, you know, specifically takes on China, France, Russia, Singapore, and the other countries that were already in 96 trying to clamp down on the free flow of information. And when the United States Congress got into the act, this is what sort of put him over the edge. This is an extreme position. It's an extreme position which he feels is justified on the basis of what? The irrelevance of physical reality, you know, in some sense, right? That, you know, bits have no dimensions and they move from one place to another instantly and they flow smoothly across borders and you know, and all the rest of that. But, you know, as we know, the internet is a bunch of computers connected together, and, you know, that means that the people who own the computers get to decide what goes through them. And, you know, we saw that in all kinds of cases. We saw it in the case of, you know, going right back to, you know, even before this, from the early 90s, the case of, you know, Bob and Carlene Thomas and their adult action bulletin board, which was fine in Milpitas, California, but not fine in Nashville, Tennessee. So, you know, we've known already long before Barlow even wrote this that space is not irrelevant in cyberspace. Physical location is not irrelevant in cyberspace.